degrees in Racine, 27 this morning in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interesting interviews for you today, beginning with a short interview with a very talented new writer named Nick Brooks, talking about his novel for young readers called Promise Boys, which springs in large measure from the real-life work that he did working with at-risk youth in Washington, D.C. Part two of today's program is a very special item that comes out of the morning show archives, a conversation I was very privileged to record several years ago with Melba Petillo Beals. She was one of the so-called Little Rock Nine who helped to integrate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. But what a dangerous and fraught with tension situation that was for Melba and those other young students. Her book about that is called March Forward, Girl, From Young Warrior to Little Rock Nine. We'll hear that a little bit later in the hour. Here's part one of today's program. And I'm spending a precious few minutes with Nick Brooks, who is an award-winning author and filmmaker, and I'm sure many of you are acquainted with his outstanding short film, Hoop Dreamin'. And he is right now on at work on his first feature film, but in the otherwise, he is giving to the world now a new book called Promise Boys. And this is something of, some call it a social thriller, intended for young adult readers, but something that a whole lot of us need to read and take in. First of all, Nick Brooks, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
This is a book that some call a social thriller. Explain what that genre is all about.
Absolutely. Well, I feel, you know, film like Get Out is something that really cracked that genre wide open. And basically what that is a film with thrilling elements that we're used to, that we're accustomed to, but that has very strong themes, right? Social themes that come through that teach us a strong moral lesson. And so for Promise Boys, it is a thriller. It's a murder mystery about, you know, three boys who are accused of murdering their principal, right, in their very own school. But at the same time, we take a very close examination of what schools do to kids of color in underserved communities, right? So, you know, we have this very thrilling element, this kind of head-spinning mystery, but at the same time, we have themes that people will definitely notice as they read the book, and hopefully we'll start some conversations around how we educate our kids in these communities.
The young students in this book just leap off the page. They feel so vivid. They feel so real. Explain how you created each of these characters and, in a sense, what you drew upon in your own life in order to shape each character so convincingly.
Absolutely. Well, me, you know, I grew up in D.C. I came through DCPS. I coached Little League football. I worked with at-risk youth in middle school and high schools, and I taught there. And so the characters, JB, Trey, Ramon, are all, you know, amalgamations of kids that I've worked with, and even a lot of myself poured into each one of them. For example, JB being the aspiring rapper, you know, growing up for me, my writing journey started with writing lyrics. For Ramon being the dreamer, and you see me now, I'm talking to you because I'm a dreamer. You know, I started writing at 14 and kept that dream going. And same thing for Trey. Trey is one of my personal favorites because on the outside, he's bubbly, he's smiling, he's cracking jokes. But if you read the book, you know that at home, Trey isn't the happiest because of the discipline that his uncle is trying to impress upon him. And that's, you know, a little bit of my story. You know, I was the kid who in school was lively and not necessarily cracking a lot of jokes, but I had a smile on my face. But I didn't necessarily always want to be at home. For me, school was like an escape, and for Trey, it's very much the same. And so, you know, the way I was able to paint these kids again was just by pouring a lot of myself into them and just using the experiences that I had with all the young men that I've worked with in and around D.C. and also giving each of my characters a piece of that as well.
Mm. We can tell that you are a filmmaker. There is just something kind of cinematic about the way that this story unspools. Is that a conscious thing? I mean, as you are crafting this book, for instance, are you thinking about the way in which this could exist on the screen, or are you just writing a book that just happens to have that flavor of cinema, in a sense?
Well, no, you're exactly right. It's definitely a conscious decision. You know, I graduated from USC Film School in 2020, you know, which they say is the number one film school in the world, the USC Mafia, as the they say in L.A. And so when I started writing the book, which was in 2020, that's exactly what I was thinking about. How do I take this thing that I'm making and continue it in some of my other disciplines? And, of course, thinking about cinema and screen was where my mind went. And so, yes, it was 100% a conscious decision and one that I think will pay off.
Before we let you go, I need to ask you about the work that you did with At-Risk Youth. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, when you think about that experience, what do you feel like you learned the most, kind of about the human condition and what lessons did these young students teach you, even as you were trying to guide them?
Yeah, man, really resilience. You know, I mean, some of the things that I saw that my kids were going through, I know would cripple most adults, to be honest. I had students that were homeless, students that were abused, students that, you know, I knew what they were doing to make money for their family. I mean, all types of situations. And what I really saw was the resilience and how powerful these kids were, how smart and how brilliant these kids were, even though society may look at them and think less. And so a lot of that, again, when we talk about the social thriller, kind of circling back to that, that's one of the themes in the book, is that these kids are resilient, they're powerful, they're brave, and they deserve more of our grace.
Mm. Very well put. The book is Promise Boys, and the author is Nick Brooks. Nick Brooks, thank you for giving the world this really terrific book, and thank you for being my guest on The Morning Show. Best wishes.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're turning now to the Morning Show archives for a very special program that we are replaying in honor of Black History Month. I'm not sure I can adequately express how honored I feel to be speaking with a woman by the name of Melba Patillo Beals, who is one of nine young people who were part of something incredibly important when they marched into Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. They were African American, and they were integrating Central High School. What a dramatic moment that was in our history. And all of these years later, the significance of that incredible, dramatic moment resonate very, very powerfully. Well, Melba Patillo-Beals has written several different books about that experience, including I Will Not Fear, My Story of a Lifetime of Building Faith Under Fire, and Warriors Don't Cry, a searing memoir of the battle to integrate Little Rock Central High. But her most recent attempt at writing about this moment in our history and her part in it is a book intended for younger readers. It's called March Forward, Girl, From Young Warrior to Little Rock Nine. The book is published by HMH Books for Young Readers. And Melba Patillo-Beals has done great work through her life as both a journalist and communications consultant. And again, this book we're talking about today is called March Forward, Girl. Melba Patillo-Beals, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. It is my blessing. Please call me Melba.
I will do that, and thank you again for making time for this. I have to say, before we start talking about the book itself, that I just read that you were born on December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor Day, the day the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. So
I was. So, some of us have traumatic lives. I've had quite a traumatic life.
I guess so. So you were born on a day when history changed, and of course you were part of yet another very significant day when history changed.
Right, and if you look at the pattern of my life, it's pretty much matched that. You know.
I wonder if you could say a word about the challenge of writing about your life and the difficulties of your childhood and what it was like to live in Little Rock, Arkansas, in a time when bigotry was so rampant, what it was like to write about that with young people in mind, young readers in mind. What did you think about in terms of deciding how to do that?
You have to have a goal, first of all. I think I'm a mom. I'm a twice mom. I've just finished my second generations of children. I adopted a set when I was 50. And so you have to know children, I think. I've been a teacher, both in the earliest and the latest of grades. And so I have familiarity with children and how they perceive. So I had some experience. And my goal, you have to have a goal, my goal was to not preach, but to show people, this is what it's like when you oppress. Do keep this in mind. It is such a painful experience for the target of your expression, your oppression, that you need to know what you're doing in somebody's life when you do that to them. You need to know the constancy of the misery, the anticipation that that person must develop. And, you know, just look at this and see if you can get into some of these feelings, and maybe you won't do it. Yeah.
And, of course, the challenge is to write that, in this particular case, for young people to try to understand a world quite different, if not completely different, from the world in which they themselves live. I think
it's really simplistic. You have to really be simple and not leave anything out. Because young people observe what we as adults take for granted.
You tell us,
for example, I talk about that the first time I really knew that we lived someplace odd, I was 3 years old. And what I noticed was not necessarily what one might think. I noticed how my parents' expression, behavior had changed when we left home and went into public. We went to the grocery store, which was a couple blocks away. They would kowtow, curtsy, bow, let white people get in line in front of them. And, you know, little kids know it's not your turn. It's my turn to be in line, and you're going to jump in front of me for no reason? Well, I want to go home and play with my toys. I don't want to be in the grocery store, and therefore I'm not happy about it. I think people get that point, you know.
Absolutely. I was surprised to read in the very first chapter of the book, so this is when you are still quite young, and you are already starting to notice some of these indignities suffered by you and your parents and so on. You write, "I imagined there must be places beyond Arkansas where my folks were treated better." Now, this is before there was any television in your home, because you tell us some years later when you finally got television and you saw once in a while certain famous African-Americans on television being treated very respectfully, and that was certainly a clear indication that somewhere out there black people were treated kindly and with respect. But even at a young age, you had a sense that that might be true.
Yeah, but it was based on the fact that I had two uncles, two dapper uncles that used to come down from Michigan all the time. They'd come down every couple of months. And, I had relatives that lived outside that boundary, and they'd come down there, and they would immediately get in trouble. But their visiting was significant because they would hold me on their lap and talk to me, and they'd say to me, you know, "You should come back home with me, because at home, if you come back, you could do so many things that you can't do here."
Hmm.
So, yeah, there was a reason. And just in my, I can't tell you this, but just in my heart and in my soul, for example, the one thing I've always thought since the beginning of my life is I want to live at the edge. And I used to go back and tell my grandmother, "I'm going to live at the edge." And my grandmother said, "What do you mean by the edge?" And I said, "At the edge of the earth."
Hmm. Where things would be better.
No, in this case, I just thought that I could breathe better. Mm. I had really, really bad asthma. And I could envision a place like California where there was an ocean just beyond. And I could breathe better if there was water.
We're speaking with Melba Patillo-Beals, and her book, March Forward Girl, tells her about her experience of growing up in Little Rock, Arkansas, and ultimately of being one of the so-called Little Rock Nine who were brought in to integrate Central High School. You have very, very warm feelings, I'm sure, to this very day for your grandma, who you call at one point your very best friend. I could ask you about so many things you tell us about, but I want to have you describe to our listeners something that you call garden time with your grandma. Explain what garden time was all about and what a difference it made for you as a youngster.
Well, she always had a garden. And so every day at watering time and gardening time, I'd go with her. And I'd stand beside her and hold on to her dress while she was watering. Sometimes I'd get very wet. And she would talk to me about anything I wanted to talk about. It was my turn. So she would say, "Now, what is happening to you today? What's in your mind? What do you wonder about? What do you want to talk about? Do you have any questions for me?" And I always did.
Hmm.
Why are the men so big? And why do they get to be those people? And
yeah, well, who writes these rules that makes white people feel like they're better than everybody else? I wonder if you could talk about those experiences you had in your life when you would be overtaken by what you called my Little Rock feelings. Those were the feelings of fear, of just like something in your gut, a knot in the stomach. And this would not be at home, and this wouldn't be at church, but this would be when you were out and about, for instance, at the grocery store. You hated going to the grocery store. Explain what going to the grocery store was like and what made it so hurtful for you.
Well, little kids want to do what? They want to touch everything. So the rule in the grocery store was black people couldn't touch anything because they said if we touched it, nobody would want to buy it, right? Mm. We'd make it all tainted and stinky. Well, that, what do you mean, stinky? I take baths every night.
If a black person touched anything on the shelves, then a white person coming along behind them wouldn't want to purchase
right.
that. So you were forbidden from touching anything at all.
What are we going to do about this? But it was just so hard to think that when I got into public, I had to stand a certain way, stand in a certain place. usually wait for somebody to come along. But if that didn't happen, we would plan on burning a whole day.
Explain the so-called rules of survival, which you were told about by your grandmother and your mother and father, for that matter. What were those rules of survival, and what were the ones that were hardest for you to follow as a youngster?
Well, okay, so don't look a white person in the face. We know that Emmett Till got killed for that one. If somebody's coming down a sidewalk, and you're walking up the sidewalk, you step off into the mud. No matter the gender or age or anything, this person, it's you do it. If someone is studying a library, you open it up and sell it.
You tell us that church was one place where you felt, at least for the most part, very, very safe. That was a place of community, of fellowship, and a place where the fears that you felt in a place like the grocery store or the department store were just not a part of the proceedings. You experienced...
No, you step inside of there, and the most important thing you felt at church in the beginning was safety. Nobody's going to hit me. Nobody's going to call me a nigger. It's going to be so great. My parents are going to smile. They're going to get that Are you or Frank smile off their face? And they're going to get the real smile. And it's going to be so nice there, you know.
There is something truly terrifying and horrifying that you witness. I believe not in your own church. I believe it was in another church where you actually witnessed someone from the Ku Klux Klan invading that space, that holy space, in a way that had to be truly sickening for you, especially when one thinks about if church for you was a place of sanctuary, in the truest sense of the word, nothing could have been more terrible than to have that sense of sanctuary shattered. Did church?
Well, isn't God somebody? To each and every one of us, no matter who we are, God is somebody. And God was the church, according to Grandma, and everybody in my family. And so, therefore, if there was a human, absolutely one inch of anything, the happiness of it all would be shown to you at church. That's how I felt. But eventually, I had to understand that that wasn't, if it had been used, abused.
You tell us about those moments when you would have glimmers of hope, such as when your grandma told you about a baseball player by the name of Jackie Robinson, and you remember listening to him on the radio and feeling some sense of hope. Something else that gave you a tremendous sense of hope was when you and your family visited St. Louis, Missouri. Say a quick word about why that trip was such a dramatic one for you, and why it was hard to return to Little Rock.
Yeah, by this time I was a young teenager, and I got to experience what I had envisioned. There was the city where white folks didn't just call you a nigger on the street. You could walk into a store and touch the merchandise. I mean, it was so fabulous. There were, just what was out, the groceries and stuff. You could touch anything you want. I mean, it was beyond my comprehension.
And, of course, you write about how it made it even worse when you got back on that train, a segregated train, and returned to Little Rock and returned to that life where life meant so many indignities on a daily basis.
Unbelievable. And in the church, I witnessed a man be hanged. So now you've taken away the only sanctuary I have in my life. If you're riding a bus, you're vulnerable. No matter where you were, you were vulnerable now. And church wasn't an exception. and that really worried me.
Right. Your book is a book that tells us a lot about what life was like for your family and families like your family in a place like Little Rock, Arkansas. But it also, along with an unsparing portrayal of what the frustrations were of life, there were also these moments when there was hope, when once in a while you would experience kindness from a white person, or when you would receive a certain gift that might be important to you, like a gift that was given to you on your birthday in 1950, a gift from your grandma of a globe. Why do you think that globe was so extraordinarily important to you at that point?
Well, there before me was the world. There before me was a place where the Klan did not ride every afternoon at dusk. There before me were all the places I dreamed about. California that I'd seen in the 17 magazine. Things I'd seen mentioned, you know. To me, one of the most precious things in my life was magazines. Because they gave me pictures, once we could get a hold of when I was a little bit older, they gave me pictures of what was beyond my border.
Hmm.
I was a happy girl. Somebody came over with an old magazine. Ooh, it was precious. I preserved it for years.
Wow. You eventually come to have a more sophisticated understanding of what these Jim Crow laws were all about.
I was steaming when someone taught me as I got older that there's actually written on paper a set of laws that pertain to this. This is not just accidental, you know?
Well, and it also was a moment when you realized that these white people, they themselves were not, in a sense, breaking the law or, in their eyes, doing anything wrong when they were doing these things to you. They were following the law, a terrible, evil law that was in place. And, of course, that had to change everything about the way that you felt. And
to learn that there was something that granted white people permission to treat me like doggy do was startling. Because then I know that I'm doomed. Who's going to go in there and collect those people? They can treat me any way they want if they're alone. There were witnesses.
And then in 1954, there is the beginning of a dramatic change with the Supreme Court ruling in Brown versus the Board of Education saying that, in fact, separate was not equal and ordering the integration of schools, a move which was met with immense anger and resistance by most of the white community of Little Rock, including the school board, who...
Oh, on that day, that very day, I literally almost got raped by a man who said, give you niggas an inch, you take a mile. Now you think you're going to school with my babies. You're not doing that.
Mm. Tell our listeners about how you, in effect, accidentally volunteered to perhaps be considered to be one of the first black students to help integrate Central High. Explain what your teacher asked in the schoolroom that morning.
She walked through the classroom and said, will those who live in the district of Central High School raise your hand? And I did, and then she said, okay. Will those who want to go to Central High School raise their hand? Well, I did. Not everybody did. I did. And then she said, well, I have this sheet of paper you can sign. You need to give it to your parents for a signature. In compliance with the 1954 Brown decision, there will begin integration in these schools next September.
And ultimately, you were one of the nine who were selected to walk through that door of Central High School. What were the things that they were looking for in terms of carefully choosing those first nine students who would integrate Central High School? What were they looking for?
They sifted the school, and they began that sift by saying those who were did not have behavior problems, those who had good grades, those who had attitude of respect for older people, and those who were clean in their dress and their presentation. That those were the basics.
Hmm. As you approach Central High School that first day, accompanied by Little Rock. No, I think the first day, were you accompanied by anybody at all aside from your mother?
You know, the head of the local NAACP, they sort of dropped us off. In my case, I was accompanied by my mom because we were late and got separated from the others. And there was really no formal plan. I mean, the problem with that first day was we lacked a systemic plan because who the heck thought we'd be in that much trouble?
Mm.
So, but the woman who was head of the NAACP said, "Well, you know, we'll meet on a certain corner," and we did. We were supposed to, you know. Now imagine that the expanse of this school is from 14th to 16th Street. It's 8 blocks in diameter. Two across, two down, two across the back, and two up the side. So it's a big place. It's not a small place. And so we were supposed to meet on the corner of, like, I think, 14th Street. And so there we were, my mother and I. We get there, this huge crowd. It's like going to the rodeo. You know, we thought, well, what's happening? Maybe Johnny Mathis or somebody really special has come to see the opening day of school.
If only.
If only.
Yes.
And we thought, well, it sounds like a football game. You know how when you come into a football game, all the yelling and screaming. And at first you can't distinguish the words.
Right.
You just hear the yelling.
Right.
And it takes a moment for the yelling to turn into words. And there's excitement because, first of all the people are white. So it takes your mind. See, you don't really quickly discern the amount of trouble you're totally in. It takes a while for it to, wait a minute, these are white people. No black people are in here yelling and screaming like this. Why are they yelling and screaming, and what are they looking across the street at? Well, they were looking at one of our number, Elizabeth Eckford, walk a gauntlet in front of the school.
Right.
They were looking at her being escorted by a ugly group of white people who would call her every name in the book and tell her she wasn't worth it.
Well, ultimately, this mob, of course, turns you away. You return the next day with police, and eventually you have to be escorted into school with soldiers. I mean, one can hardly imagine what that was like. Have you ever stopped to think about how much your experience was a little bit like that of Jackie Robinson and what he faced when he first entered Major League Baseball?
Absolutely. But in some ways, we were children. And so somehow in my mind, I thought adults don't hurt children. You know, I'm 15 years of age. So you don't envision, at 14 and 15, I didn't envision death. I didn't envision adults would misbehave that way. I didn't envision, you know, I had to trust God from the beginning. They've been holding meetings in the white community and the black community. And in my community, my grandmother always talked to us about how we're going to get through this is we're going to trust God.
Hmm.
You know, you're not getting through this because you're so great. You get through it because in your soul there must be a belief that you're doing the right thing.
As I was reading your book, I was realizing that the news cameras only captured that ugly scene outside of Central High School as the Arkansas 9, Little Rock 9, walked up to that front door with that mob of protesters there hurling insults and so on. But cameras never showed, as far as I know at least, anything once you entered the building and what daily life was like.
At one point, one of the New York Times reporters and the Life reporters infiltrated. They were tiny people, ladies, and they came in and acted as students.
Wow.
So, but no, there was no shooting on the inside.
Right. So you're one of the only people, you and your counterparts are the only ones, in a sense, who can really say much about what day-to-day life was like. How did the experience in Central High School as a student in this otherwise all-white school compare to other incidents that you had experienced earlier in your life, experiences that brought you fear and discomfort? Was this about the same, much, much worse, not quite as bad?
No. It was the most astounding, overwhelming experience in my life, still today, and I'm 76. The change from being a fairly calm, fairly settled, safe teenager in your home, as safe as you can be, to being in this environment, it was like going to war. It was like, no, wait a minute. These people really won't kill me to keep from going to school. Then, oh, yeah, they will. They killed somebody last night. They're not practicing rope making for nothing. They'll get you, kiddo. And then what will you do?
Wow. What kind of response did you have from the teachers there versus the white students? By and large, did the teachers seem willing to teach you, albeit perhaps grudgingly?
Some of them grudgingly, some of them quite willing and helpful. If they got too friendly, they got castigated.
By some of their colleagues.
One boy screamed out loud to my English teacher at one point, you're a nigger lover, you're a nigger lover, you wait.
Wow. What kind of difference did any of the white students make in terms of the, granted, I'm sure, relatively few who were not quite so openly hostile? I mean, were there kindnesses shown to you? And through the course of the year, did that situation in any significant way improve?
Well, I would say not a lot. It improved probably 15-20%, but not because people were more willing to allow us in, but because the army, the local army's routine was much like that of the norm, and they were into a lot of other things. For example, they were just into the transition part of it, you know. And so near the end of the school, soldiers were left, and we were there by ourselves. And on the last few days of school, the vice principal, Mrs. Huckabee, offered to keep all of us like there.
Mm. At some point, you made mention of a bodyguard. Did you always have a bodyguard with you in school?
Always, but not till the end. As long as the soldiers were in town.
So it was either soldiers on duty or a bodyguard assigned to you to try
No, there was no bodyguard assigned. It was while the soldiers were in town, the bodyguard were the soldiers.
I see. So when the soldiers left, there was no bodyguard.
Goodbye.
Wow. What kind of learning were you able to do through the course of that year? That is,
well, you know, not much, but I kept my grades up. Not as good as they had been. I kept them up, however, because in my household, there's no coming home with low grades.
Right. But I was just thinking how mentally and emotionally it was such a difficult experience, such a difficult scenario in which to be able to concentrate and focus. I'm sure it had to be a really, really difficult challenge in that respect.
Well, it was one that you couldn't always discern. Like, what's going to happen to me today? How's that going down? And how can I respond in a way that will save my life? Mm. And you get more bold as the time proceeds. I got more bold, you know.
Really?
For example, at the dark end of the school, these boys trapped me. And this one boy is standing up against me, pushing me against the cabinets. And I figure out he's going to kill me. The only way I'm getting out is reaching for his testicles, and I did. You got to protect yourself. You know, in the end, also, my soldier taught me about self-protection. He said, you got to do what you got to do till you can get to safety, you know.
Hmm. How difficult was it to resist the urge to fight back in a way that might have led to your being expelled, as happened to one of the nine? I mean, was it difficult for you to, in a sense, toe the line and tolerate this kind of treatment, or were you bound and determined to do so one way or another?
I pretty much tried. We all had to follow the prescribed treatment, because what good would it have done to spend all that time tortured and mistreated and then blow it? So we really did, and it was interesting. Dr. Martin Luther King came down to visit us a couple of times, and he was really clear on saying, you set your goals in life, and that's what you work for.
Mm. You did make it through the year, but of course, in that following summer, there was a very, very frightening development with the local Ku Klux Klan that you tell us about in your book. Explain the kind of dire danger that you and the other nine suddenly found yourself in.
The whole situation of going to school with no guards was incredible. And at one point, the vice principal hid us in her office. Is that what you mean? The transitioning out was difficult.
Right.
Because by the end of the year, they were determined we were not going to go back. And the governor was absolutely determined we were not going to go back. So it was a very ugly scene. And we felt as though we had very little shield between us and those hooligans who would do bad.
Right. And who wanted to see you apprehended, perhaps even killed. Your parents...
Well, yeah, they threatened to have us beaten. And, you know, they knew the jail terms. They said, we can get up, you can't. Meant, you know, girls. It was an ugly, ugly road, pedal to the metal scene where
right.
You had to pray, you had to go rare parade up, and when something awful happened, you had to turn inward for your support.
Right.
There was no adult within the limits of that school that was going to help you, not really.
Hmm. Ultimately, your parents made what I'm sure was a difficult decision and yet a necessary decision. To have you go off to actually Santa Rosa, California to complete your high school.
Yes, because I write that I had a relative who was in the Klan, like all black families. We were a mixed black family. And he was passing the numbers, and so he called up to say, Mother Lois, how great that was. And we said, look, what's up? And he said, you're going to be killed. And we said, you know, it's up to you to attend the Klan meeting and find out what they got in store for us.
Wow. So your parents sent you off to Santa Rosa, California, and you finished your high school education there. And actually, you write in your book about actually the extraordinary experience you had about living with this family called the McCabes. Just say a word about how transformative this time was in Santa Rosa, California, and what kind of difference it made for the life that you've lived since.
Well, I landed there in great fear. See, I didn't know till I got to the airport, or I didn't know till I got to the San Francisco airport that I was going to go live with a white family. I was a black family. Nobody said that to me. And my mother really didn't know that it was a white family. And so I was just stiff with fear. But they said, come on, go home, go over. And I got into the van, and we went home, and it was a very difficult time to see life implode on the gentleman who guaranteed to get us out.
Well, you end up experiencing life as you had never experienced it before in a place where, at least for the most part, you were not the target of bigotry and discrimination as you had been.
Well, the goal was, of course, to end up in Santa Rosa. But, for example, even in Santa Rosa, there was some racism. Papa took me to swim in the pool, and they wouldn't let me swim in the pool, so Daddy made these placards and marched up and down. There was no racism in the school, however. I never once in Montgomery High School felt anything but, you know, curiosity. That love is the answer, and that not all white people were involved in this. Some of them did step up to the plate. The ministers, the Christians, stepped up to save our lives. I wouldn't be here if they didn't.
Well, it's a remarkable story, and I'm so glad you tell it as well as you do in this book, March Forward, Girl, From Young Warrior to Little Rock Nine, published by HMH Books for Young Readers. I'm sure many young people will read this and be fascinated and inspired by your story, as I was. Melba Patilla-Beals, thank you so much, and very best wishes, and thank you for being part of The Morning Show today. I was honored to speak with you.
My honor, my pleasure, my blessing. God bless.
Thank you. I want to add as a brief postscript to the interview that you've just heard that my wife Kathy and I had the great pleasure of visiting Little Rock, Arkansas in late December 2021 for the wedding of two dear friends. And as a matter of fact, on New Year's Eve day, we traveled to Central High School, which was closed that day to the public. But right across the street was an amazing visitor center filled with all kinds of fascinating displays, all kinds of intriguing resources to help one better understand the story of the Little Rock Nine and the story of the integration of Central High School. I highly recommend it. We also traveled to the State Capitol building in the heart of Little Rock, Arkansas. And outside the State Capitol is a very striking and poignant sculpture honoring the Little Rock Nine. That is also very much worth a visit. My thanks again to Melba Patillo Beals for being my morning show guest. The preceding interview with Melba Patillo Beals was recorded back in 2019. Tomorrow on the morning show, it will be the monthly visit of our good friend Nan Calvert, who always arranges for a morning show that tackles some issue related to the natural world and the environment around us. On Thursday, tomorrow, she will be joined by Regina Harders, who is president of the Root River Area Chapter of the Wild Ones, a group which lifts up the beauty of native plants while also working really hard to eradicate the invasive species that are such a blight in so many areas around us. Also, Joanne Sustacek, coordinator for the chapter's upcoming plant sale. We'll be talking with them tomorrow on the morning show. On Friday, in anticipation of Sunday's Super Bowl between the Kansas City Chiefs and the Philadelphia Eagles, I'm going to be playing an interview with Austin Murphy, who is from Sports Illustrated and responsible for a wonderful book called Super Bowl Gold, a book that came out the year of the 50th Super Bowl. And the book looks back at the long history of America's greatest game. Also, you will be hearing an excerpt from an interview called 12, which is a look at the life and amazing career of quarterback Tom Brady, who, of course, recently announced his retirement from the game. By the way, also associated with the Super Bowl coming up on Sunday, you may have heard during NPR's Morning Edition today a brief interview with Jason Reed, the author of a book called Rise of the Black Quarterback. I had the pleasure of interviewing Jason Reed on the morning show about this book, and it was, I think, an exceptionally interesting conversation. And we're going to be replaying that the day of the Super Bowl, so on Sunday in the podcast version of the morning show. So make a point of listening for that. Also, speaking of the podcast version of the morning show, every Saturday during the month of February, we are replaying one of the memorable conversations which I was privileged to have over the years with Dr. Yuri Maltsev, longtime professor of economics at Carthage College. Dr. Maltsev came to Carthage way back in 1991 and was a guest on the morning show more than a dozen times over the years. The particular interview that I will replay on Saturday's podcast of the morning show is a really interesting conversation about the disaster at Chernobyl. And The interview that I did with Professor Maltsev was either in response to a documentary film or another book which had been released about the Chernobyl disaster. But I thought it would be interesting to have Professor Maltsev share his own perspective on how that happened. And I was not disappointed. Dr. Maltsev had a very, very interesting take on Chernobyl.